Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we hear the second of three parts of a top-level conversation between Rice University professor James M. Tour, who's a world-renowned chemist and recipient of multiple prestigious awards, and philosopher of science Stephen Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture. They're continuing their discussion on problems facing naturalistic origin of life research, which keeps on discovering that chemistry just doesn't move in life-friendly directions without scientists intervening to make it happen. So what are they simulating in their research? A process that depends on mind.
It's interesting to sit with you because you and I have attended meetings together for the last several years, and we hear different people come up with their different little proposals. And as soon as you ask for details, it goes into storytelling. And it's just how utterly clueless we are. Let me begin to turn this in another direction, because you had mentioned something about this non-equilibrium. One of your colleagues, Dr. Brian Miller, so he writes about this not from the perspective that I do. I look at this from a synthetic organic chemist. He's writing about this as a physical chemist, and he writes this, and I want you to unpack this. So listen to this carefully, what he writes. Many people say that the simplest of life is a bacterium. So he says bacteria of all levels of complexity must generate in their cells, in their cell membranes, at least 100,000 ATP molecules per second per micron squared, to simply maintain their integrity against the constant thermodynamic forces disrupting their homeostatic stability. A drop in power results in the metabolism halting and the cell irreversibly decomposing into an amorphous conglomeration of simpler chemicals. So explain to us what this means, that life is a non-equilibrium system, and how nature tries to move things toward an equilibrium, and what all this means.
Right. Let me put this discussion in a little broader context. There's been a kind of a back and forth. The old line creationists used to say that the life couldn't have evolved because it violates the second law of thermodynamics. Because living systems are highly ordered, things tend to go from disorder to order, from low to high entropy, more disorder, low entropy being more order. The standard evolutionary response was, well, that's true as far as it goes, but it's overly simplistic. If you push energy through a system, you can maintain a higher level of order because of the energy moving through the system in a localized environment. Overall, you'll still have more disorder, but in a localized environment, you can maintain a high degree of order, providing you're pushing energy through a system. And since our sun is pumping energy into Earth all the time, we can have high order in our localized environment, even though in the solar system as a whole, we're moving towards disorder. And that's true as far as it goes. We have lots of examples of that. A tornado will create, the energy that produces the tornado creates a localized increase in order with a swirling vortex. But the problem is with these non-equilibrium systems that the kind of order that's produced has nothing to do with the kind of order we see in biology. It's a highly symmetric order, like a swirling vortex, or think of you could unplug your bathtub and see that make a vortex. Gravitational energy will produce that order. The kind of order we have in life is not repetitive order or symmetric order. It's actually information. Or it's complex order. And so these non-equilibrium thermodynamics explanations do a good job of explaining what doesn't need to be explained in life. If you think of the genetic code or any sequence of digital characters, if you get a repeat, ABC, 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 or in the genes, if you got AG, 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 that would be a highly repetitive order. But it's not informational. It doesn't have the capacity to produce a complex three-dimensional protein fold. That type of what's required there is much more like language. I use an example in my book of a series of randomly arranged characters, a series of repetitive characters, and then a sequence like time and tide wait for no man. That third type of sequence we say is specified and complex. It's the kind of order we have in information. Its arrangements are not rigidly repeating, and yet it's specified in order to perform a function. And so that's what the kind of thing that's got to be explained in biology, not just something like a vortex or a swirling tornado. Now, recently, there's been a scientist, Jeremy England, who was at MIT, now he's at Georgia Tech, who's written on something called, they're called dissipation theorems. And these purport to show that you can have, life is special in two ways. It's special because it's a low entropy system, and it also has a lot of energy. It's high thermal energy. And to get those two things, it's highly ordered, but in a specific informational way, and it's storing energy. And so that makes life very difficult to explain. It's unusual. If we look out, we see lots of things that have energy in them, but they're not highly ordered, especially not with informational order. And we see lots of things that might be low entropy, but they don't have energy. Life has those two things in concert. Now, there are these dissipation theorems that say that that can happen in very specific circumstances. And so Jeremy England wrote some articles saying, hey, maybe this is a way that this might show some promise for explaining the origin of life from purely physical thermodynamic considerations. What Brian showed, however, was that these same dissipation theorems show that to get low entropy and high thermal energy in the same system, you can do it, but you can only do it if you have an engine that converts energy in very specific ways to that low entropy system, and also only if you have information. So you need an engine and information. In fact, to build engines like ATP molecules inside cells, you've got to put a lot of proteins together in a very particular way, so you're going to need a lot of information. So you can get the order for free if you have the pre-existing information. And that's been the whole basis of our case for intelligent design in life, is that information is something that we know only arises from a mind, from an intelligence. So these dissipation theorems that looked like they were going to provide an avenue for explaining the origin of life from fundamental physical principles actually just underscored in a new way the need for prior unexplained information that we think, again, can only be explained by reference to a mind.
Good. Well, thank you. And I'm gonna follow on that same thought. I'm speaking right now to Dr. Stephen Meyer. And so, Dr. Stephen Meyer, I'm gonna follow along that same thought. You know that I have not been a proponent of intelligent design, though I'm quite sympathetic with the arguments. Neither have I contested with intelligent design. My whole argument has been I don't have a chemical tool to measure it, and I am holding my colleagues to using our chemical tools to define what they're proposing. So they tell these stories and they say, okay, what chemical tool did you use so that you could tell me this story? What was it that you measured? So what would you say that to move me even closer toward intelligent design, if I don't have a tool to measure it, what are the ways that are being thought about to really put a measure on this? Because your colleague, Dr. Brian Miller, told me that that's what they're moving toward.
Well, it's a great question. And this is what's been so enjoyable for me about our conversations, is that in a sense, we're looking at the same reality, at two sides of the same coin. Because you've been analyzing these prebiotic simulation experiments and showing that the chemistry doesn't want to do what the origin of life biologists say it must do in order to produce life, right? It doesn't move in a life-friendly direction. In those first Miller-Urey experiments, unless there was the investigator interference to prevent the interfering cross reactions, this experiments would terminate in a substance called melanoidin, which was a kind of sludge that had absolutely nothing to do with life. So the investigator had to reach in and take out the byproducts that they didn't want and make sure that, you know, that they didn't get those interfering cross reactions, and then introduce something else at just the right time, and still we didn't get very far along the way. So you've just done this fantastic job with the benefit of your expertise in synthetic organic chemistry of showing this fundamental truth that the chemistry, organic chemistry, does not move naturally in a life-friendly direction. And what you've done is you've called out these investigators for the way in which they've interfered with the experiments, where they've set them up, they've choreographed them, they've interfered, and used their own intelligence to get what limited positive results are possible. And so that, I think, has been a really powerful negative critique of the plausibility of these origin of life scenarios. What I've done in looking at the logic of origin of life simulation experiments and in the logic of historical scientific theorizing is to show that there's also a positive case for intelligent design. In part, it's based on something we can measure, and that is the amount of information that is present or would need to be present in even the simplest living cell. Because we have the ability to calculate very precisely the probabilistic resources of the entire universe. And I made some of these calculations in Signature in the Cell. So if you get beyond a particular threshold of information, we know that it will always be more likely that undirected material processes did not produce that information than it is that the undirected material processes did produce that information. And we're way beyond that threshold. And I unpack that quantitative threshold and the sort of probabilistic argument in Signature in the Cell. But there's more to the case for intelligent design than just the measurement of information. It's also our uniform and repeated experience of what it takes to generate information. And here I build in my case for intelligent design off of the work of Charles Darwin and the other 19th century historical scientists who developed a method of reasoning for investigating the events in the remote past and what caused those events. And their key insight was, if you want to explain an event in the remote past, you need to posit a cause which is known in our experience, in our present experience, to produce the effect in question. And I came across this first in the work of Darwin and then in Lyell. Lyell had a long Victorian subtitle on his famous book, Principles of Geology. It was being an attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface by reference to causes now in operation. That's the critical methodological principle in historical science. And origin of life biology is an historical science. So if we want to figure out what caused life to come into existence or what caused the information necessary to produce life, we need to ask, well, what is the cause now in operation that produces information? And as I began to frame that question, I realized we know of only one such cause that produces information, especially information in a digital form, such as the information we find in DNA and RNA. And that cause is an intelligent agent. Whether we're talking about a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or digital code in a computer program or information embedded in a radio signal, whenever we trace information back to its ultimate source, we always come to a mind, not an undirected process. And now, curiously, even origin of life biochemists have confirmed this principle with their very simulation experiments that you've critiqued so powerfully. Because what they've shown is that to get, for example, there's a particular type of origin of life experiment called a ribozyme engineering experiment, where the origin of life scientists are trying to produce an RNA molecule that will both store information and catalyze reactions, and hoping, perhaps, and even hoping that they'll get one that can partially copy itself, a replicase, to get some kind of natural selection going at a prebiotic level. To date, they've been able to engineer RNA molecules that can copy about 10% of themselves. But to do that, the origin of life biochemist, the ribozyme engineer, has to precisely sequence the nucleotide bases on the RNA molecule to get even that limited self-replicating capacity possible. So what's being simulated? What's being simulated is that to generate information, you need a mind. Even RNA world experiments are showing this same principle, that intelligence is the prerequisite of information. And I remember years ago at that same conference, you gave that excellent talk on how information could exist in the cloud, because we can put it there. Because if there's a mind, you can put information in a cloud. It can be stored on any material medium. So I think both our ordinary experience and our scientific experience has confirmed this principle that information always comes from a mind. So the discovery of information at the foundation of life, therefore, becomes a powerful indicator of prior intelligent activity using the methodological principles and the scientific method of reasoning that Darwin himself employed in the Origin of Species. So a proper historical scientific inference.
That was the second part of three in a conversation between James M. Tour and Stephen C. Meyer on Origin of Life research. We'll conclude the series later this week, or if you want to catch it later, you can look up James M. Tour at idthefuture.com. As always, we ask for your help getting the word out on intelligent design, and you can do that just by going to your podcast app of choice and leaving a favorable rating and review there for ID the Future. It really does help a lot. Until next time for ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.